From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
He's totally immobile. He can't move a limb or a digit. The only control he has of muscular control is his eyeballs. He can move his eyes around, and that's how we communicate.
Lou Gehrig's disease, the Pentagon admits after years of denial that Gulf War veterans are close to three times more likely to contract it. The Supreme Court agrees to decide whether U.S. officials can be sued for lying to lawyer Jennifer Harbury about the fate of her Guatemalan husband. He was captured, tortured, and executed by Guatemalan officers on the payroll of the CIA. And handgun sales are up. United We Stand pistols have hit the market. The gun lobby plays to fear, prejudice, and patriotism. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. bombing raids in the eastern Tora Bora mountain region are continuing despite an al-Qaeda offer to surrender. Western news sources say fighters had agreed to surrender by early today and the deadline passed, but the Afghan Islamic Press and a spokesperson for a U.S.-backed Afghan commander both say the fighters are asking to be handed over to the United Nations in the presence of diplomats from their respective countries. Spokesperson said if the fighters didn't surrender within a couple of hours, they'll be killed. NBC News is reporting hundreds of Taliban and al-Qaeda troops, including many of their remaining leaders, have escaped from Afghanistan into neighboring Iran and Pakistan. U.S. officials believe almost all the remaining top 22 Taliban leaders have escaped into Pakistan, mostly on foot or horseback over remote mountain trails. Meanwhile, as many as 500 Taliban and al-Qaeda troops captured in the northern cities of Mazar-i-Sharif and Kunduz have bought safe passage into Iran. Soldiers from the U.S. 10th Mountain Division are patrolling the areas along the Pakistani border, while Pakistan said it had sent 4,000 troops to the area. A federal grand jury in Virginia handed up the first criminal charges in the September 11th attacks. The charges allege a French citizen in U.S. custody was trained and funded by Osama bin Laden's network and was part of the conspiracy to crash jetliners into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Following a contentious debate among senior government officials, the White House on Monday decided to try Zacharias Moussaoui in civilian court rather than a secret military tribunal. Senior Pentagon officials and other administration officials had lobbied vigorously last month to make Moussaoui to be tried by an overseas tribunal. And after heated criticism over the use of tribunals, the Bush administration reached a compromise that would permit the trial to be held in an open criminal court, but in a jurisdiction with a strong record of imposing the death penalty. President Bush will soon tell Russia the U.S. will withdraw from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty, this according to administration officials. The Russians had hoped to preserve the treaty, which they see as a foundation of strategic stability and the cornerstone of arms control agreements hammered out over the past three decades. A U.S. withdrawal, many defense and foreign policy experts have warned, could risk soured relations with Russia, strained ties with NATO allies, and arms buildup by China, and an unraveling of other international accords. In a speech at the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina yesterday, President Bush used the September 11th attacks to justify breaking the treaty. He said, quote, "Suppose the Taliban and the terrorists had been able to strike America or important allies with a ballistic missile. Our coalition would have become fragile. We must protect America and her friends against all forms of terror, including the terror that could arrive on a missile." Driving Bush to act on the treaty now, officials said, was the fact that an expanded Pentagon plan of missile defense testing and development already has begun, straining the accord. Israeli helicopter gunships attacked the Palestinian Authority's National Security Building in the Gaza Strip last night, killing four Palestinian civilians, injuring some 20 people. The building is located in a residential part of the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Witnesses said the gunships also hit an adjacent refugee camp and said there were a large number of victims because the attack coincided with the end of evening prayers. House and Senate negotiators yesterday agreed on a far-reaching education plan that would dramatically expand student testing and hold schools responsible for closing the achievement gap separating many poor and minority students and their middle-class and white peers. Approval of the plan, which had been stalled in congressional negotiations since summer, clears the way for final action on the measure within a week. Former President Bill Clinton arrived in Glasgow Monday night and was met by protesters burning his effigy. The Jewish National Fund had invited Clinton to be its guest speaker at a fundraising dinner. The charity said the event was to raise money for the construction of a reservoir in Israel, but pro-Palestinian supporters said the group was set up 100 years ago to buy land in the Palestinian territories. And this news from the home front, Pacifica National Programming Director Utrice Lead has resigned. This according to a memo from the Pacifica Executive Director, Joanne Meredith. Lead is the ex-talk show host from Pacifica Station WBAI here in New York, who was installed as interim general manager of that station close to a year ago in what has been dubbed the Christmas coup, with late-night lock changes and the termination of longtime staffers Bernard White, Sharon Harper, and Valerie Van Isler. Firings and bannings followed, along with the installation of a high-tech security surveillance system, a precipitous drop in listenership and donations. After Lead forced the Democracy Now! Staff out of the station in mid-August, she was promoted to the network's second-highest management position. National Programming Director, again, Utrice Lead, has resigned. Let's not point the finger. Lie, 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 Denny Binet. Bigger is always better. That's the name of the record. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court agreed this week to decide whether former Clinton administration officials, such as Secretary of State Warren Christopher or former National Security Advisor Anthony Lake, could be sued by human rights lawyer Jennifer Harbury for deliberately misleading her about the fate of her Guatemalan husband. Jennifer Harbury was married to Efraim Bamaca Velasquez, a Mayan guerrilla commander known as Comandante Everardo, who was fighting the Guatemalan military. Everardo was captured in 1993, tortured for more than a year, and executed under the watch of a Guatemalan military officer who was on the payroll of the CIA. After Everardo disappeared, Jennifer Harbury fasted, first for more than a month in front of the Guatemalan presidential palace, and then for 3 weeks in front of the White House, seeking information about what had happened to him. Harbury later filed several lawsuits against U.S. government agencies and individual officials, charging they repeatedly lied to her about what they knew of her husband's death. As a result of her case, the CIA was forced to implement guidelines which supposedly restrict its ability to put human rights abusers on its payroll as intelligence assets or covert operatives. Then came the September 11th attack. Suddenly, intelligence reforms brought about by Jennifer Harbury's case were being blamed for handicapping the efforts of U.S. officials to fight terrorism. Now, lawyers representing the former Clinton administration officials named in the suit are saying what's at stake is covert operations, and that has direct ramifications for Afghanistan. We're joined on the telephone now by Jennifer Harbury, lawyer and human rights activist, speaking to us from Texas. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Jennifer.
Well, I'm always very happy to be on your show, Amy.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Can you start off by talking about exactly what the Supreme Court ruled and its significance?
Yes, I'd be glad to. There is actually a very narrow portion of the case that is going up on appeal to the Supreme Court at this time. There were two halves of the case.
Can you talk as loud as you can?
Yes, I'm sorry. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
There is only a very narrow question going up to the Supreme Court for review at this time. A large chunk of the case remains in the district court dealing with common law issues. There is only one constitutional question on appeal at this moment, and that is my right as a United States citizen to have access to the courts of law. This claim arises out of a very old line of cases, starting with the old medical experimentation cases. And what that law or case, a body of law, says is that if the government conceals information or in any other way interferes with a person's ability to bring a lawsuit in order to avoid being sued, such as the old medical experimentation cases when a person might be fed barium, for example, or another toxic substance, and those medical records would be concealed forever to avoid a malpractice suit or a tort suit, then the government has blocked that person's ability to go to court and seek justice, and that is a denial of a constitutional right. There's many more recent cases along that vein involving police brutality where evidence reports and forensic evidence and so forth are concealed or not forthright turned over to the other side, the plaintiffs. Again, that's considered a violation of the access to courts. In my case, during the time period that certain state officials were aware and receiving CIA bulletins that Everardo was still alive, and they possessed information that could have been turned over to me that were non-sensitive, that same information which later was declassified and turned over to me because it was not sensitive. If that declassifiable material had been turned over to me while they knew he was still alive, I could have gone to the federal courts and asked for an emergency order requiring the CIA to properly supervise and control their employees and to force them to bring Everardo before the courts of law. That would have saved his life.
Can you talk about what exactly happened to your husband, Efraim Bamaca Velasquez?
Yes, he was captured alive by the Guatemalan military in March of 1992. They decided that they needed to torture him for his information because of his very high rank within the URNG. They obviously did not want interference from any outside international human rights groups or to have any difficulties with the United States Congress, which is, of course, prohibited from supporting financially any army known to be involved in systematic and gross human rights violations. They didn't want any of their funding or assistance cut off. So they literally faked his death, claiming that he had died in combat, and held him then for several years, apparently, under severe torture, including the injection with a toxic gas and holding him in a full body cast to prevent his escape. He was then either thrown from a helicopter or dismembered without trial.
You fasted twice. If you had gotten that information, and it's certainly put your own life in peril, can you describe that period afterwards when you were trying to find him and what it meant to stand in front of the Guatemalan presidential palace?
Well, of course, if I had been Guatemalan, I would have been immediately tossed into a car with black glass windows, and my mutilated body would have appeared in the streets not long thereafter. It's not something that can be done within Guatemala, but again, the Guatemalan military was as aware as I am of the congressional prohibition on assisting a gross and systematic human rights violator such as themselves. The Guatemalan army, I would remind everyone, had long been declared one of the worst human rights violators in the hemisphere, and the United Nations Truth Commission, in fact, had found them guilty of genocide in their post-war review and report, as well as they found them responsible for 93% of all of the civil rights and human rights atrocities which had taken place. For me to stand before the National Palace, I felt that I was not only insisting on a bottom line for how the Guatemalan army could treat its prisoners, including my husband, I felt that I was speaking for so many of my friends who had either lost their own lives or lost family members close to them. I just felt that I had known so many people who had been dragged away and tortured and mutilated, or who had marched in the square for years and years trying to find out what had happened to their loved ones and been killed for that. I felt like I was speaking for all of them. And I just felt that it was my obligation and an honor to be able to stand up for that and to try to save the life of the person that I cared so much about.
We're talking to human rights lawyer Jennifer Harbury. She's one of the lawyers for Leonard Peltier, the Native American leader who is serving a life sentence in prison. And she continues to pursue her own case, the case of her husband, Guatemalan Comandante, who was killed by the Guatemalan officer on the payroll of the CIA. Can you talk about who El Pires was, the man responsible for your husband's death, and how you did ultimately find out the U.S. connections and that your husband was alive when you were looking for him?
Colonel El Pires is, still is, a high-level Guatemalan military intelligence official who, according to a number of government reports, as well as knowledge that one would get from information and witnesses within Guatemala at very high levels, was intimately involved in the Scorched Earth and Massacre campaign in the rural highlands, the Mayan highlands in Guatemala, throughout the 80s. According to the report, he excelled in the campaign of liquidation of anyone believed to be involved in the guerrilla movement or anyone even suspected of sympathizing with them. Liquidated, of course, means assassinated in a secret cell. The campaign being referred to is one in which 660 Mayan villages were literally erased from the map in the Quiché area. And when a large chunk of the 200,000 death squad victims were in fact killed in Guatemala, all of this occurred between 1980, say, and 1985. Although the killings continued for many years thereafter. For him to have excelled at that particular campaign means he excelled at that portion of the war, which has been legally ruled to be genocide by the United Nations Truth Commission. He is also described as a highly dangerous and unstable person by those who have fled Guatemala to escape from him and whom I have interviewed. He is very interestingly implicated in the murder of U.S. citizen Michael Devine, as well as my husband. And he is on and has been on the CIA's payroll as what is called an informant or an asset or secret informant. In other words, he gives information to the CIA in return for a large chunk of money. He got close to $40,000 from the CIA the same month that he was seen bending over my husband's torture table. According to the Intelligence Oversight Board report, which came out a year after the Torricelli report, it was confirmed that more than one CIA asset or secret informant was paid to obtain information from my husband or was on the CIA's paid informant list at that time. And we certainly have a great deal about Alpidas and my husband's torture in the CIA reports, the State Department reports, and numerous other government reports, which were released as non-sensitive materials through the Freedom of Information Act. In other words, not state secrets. The fact that Everardo was still alive throughout 1993 is in the CIA reports to the State Department and to the White House during that time period. And I also know that he was still alive from eyewitnesses who have fled the Army and from military persons within the Army who have chosen to give me information, confirming the U.S. government reports.
Jennifer Harbury, as we wrap up, can you put this in the context of a post-911 world as the President Bush talks about a war on terrorism, clearly with the emphasis being terrorists are from other countries? You're suing Clinton administration officials like Anthony Lake, like the former Secretary of State Warren Christopher.
That is correct. I'm suing them for having blocked my attempt to rescue my husband by giving me complete disinformation and as well as disinformation to the Congress. This is very interesting because I, of course, am frequently asked if I see a relationship in any way to the September 11th attacks. And I think it's important to remember that there are two categories of CIA activities that have always been major issues. The first I actually wrote about in a editorial a number of years ago when the Anti-Terrorism Commission was reaching its rulings, which is the CIA's legitimate activities in terms of obtaining information to prevent hijackings, to prevent bombings, to prevent acts of terror. I have no problem with anyone purchasing information from anybody if it's in order to prevent slaughter of the type we saw on September 11th. I don't care who they purchase it from. What I do care about is what we saw, for example, on the other September 11th, back in 1973 in Chile, when in fact the CIA backed General Pinochet in entering Chile, in assassinating the legally elected president, in bombing the Moneda, their capital building, and in rounding thousands of political persons adverse to their political position and their economic platform, and slaughtering them in the National Stadium. I think we have to remember what total shock and horror the people of Chile must have felt during those early years. I think that in Guatemala, the same thing occurred. We have the CIA in 1954 carrying out a violent coup against a legally elected president and then backing a military that has been found literally and legally guilty of genocide for the next 35 years. The torture of Everardo was not carried out in order to obtain information about the bombing of any civilian within the United States. The security of anyone in the United States was not even at issue, was not a concern in any way. He was being tortured in order to help carry out the socioeconomic campaign or platform of the government in power at that time, which was the Guatemalan military, and the CIA assisted in that. That's exactly the kind of activity I think has to be limited, because if we ourselves in the United States do not respect basic human rights norms, then we cannot expect anyone else throughout the world to respect it either. And I just think that what I've been seeing, the rolling back of human rights positions and advances that have been made for the last 100 years, we're going to come to deeply regret later.
Well, Jennifer Harbury, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Jennifer Harbury, human rights lawyer, her husband in Guatemala killed by a Guatemalan officer on the payroll of the CIA. This U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear her case that allows her to decide whether U.S. allows the Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case to decide whether U.S. officials can be sued for lying to her about the fate of her husband. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll take a look at United We Stand pistols that have hit the market. We'll look at the gun lobby in the United States. Stay with us.
They told me, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum, a newborn king to see, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum. Our finest gifts we bring, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum, rum-ba-bum-bum, rum-ba-bum-bum. Peace on earth, can it be? Years from now, perhaps we'll see. Our see the day of glory. See the day of living peace. So peace on earth. When we come.
Peace on Earth, Little Drummer Boy, David Bowie, Bing Crosby here on the War and Peace Report. Violence begets violence. As the bombs drop in Afghanistan, crimes of all kinds are up across the United States. Americans are arming themselves in the wake of the September 11th attacks. Gun retailers across the country report significant increases in gun sales, particularly first-time buyers. And the gun industry has helped to increase gun sales by creating special issue patriotic guns. Beretta, the oldest gun manufacturer in the world, just released their latest model, a limited edition 92F 9mm United We Stand pistol, which features a laser-etched gold American flag and the words United We Stand. They'll make a total of 2,001 commemorative pieces. Beretta says the pistol is, quote, a testament that the American spirit will not be diminished during this national crisis. They'll donate some of the proceeds to the NYPD Foundation and Survivors Fund. Ithaca Gun Company is also getting in on the trend. They've created a Homeland Security model rifle, complete with a patriotic sales pitch. Quote, in our current time of national need, Ithaca Gun is ready to meet the challenge. In every respect, these new Homeland Security model shotguns are up to the demanding tasks which lay before us as a nation. And then there's the soon-to-be-released 50-caliber rifle from Tromex Company called the Turbine Chaser. Several weeks after September 11th, the California Rifle and Pistol Association, a California affiliate of the NRA, launched a billboard campaign in Los Angeles featuring a diverse group of smiling people and the words, "Society is safer when criminals don't know who's armed." Asked about the appropriateness of the message at this time, a spokesman said the message was truer than ever in light of what happened in New York City. People have stopped taking for granted their own security. Then in the investigation of September 11th attacks, the FBI is seeking whether any of the detained had purchased guns. But U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft, an avowed opponent of gun control, has prohibited the FBI from checking the names of some 1,200 detainees against the list. When he was a Missouri state senator, Ashcroft sponsored legislation that would have required destruction of the records as soon as the check was complete. As ardently as the Attorney General has been prosecuting the war on terrorism, it seems more than a little odd he would thwart attempts to see if terrorist suspects had purchased guns in the United States. At a December 6th hearing, Ashcroft declared that FBI checks of gun records would violate the privacy of foreigners being detained on suspicion of possible connections to the September 11th hijackers. We're joined on the phone by Nan Aaron, president of the Alliance for Justice Gun Industry Watch Project. Can you address all of these issues?
That's a tall order, but thank you for having me on. We have just launched at the Alliance for Justice a new project that will organize grassroots activities around the country aimed at gun manufacturers and the gun lobbying. We are particularly concerned with some of the new weapons being marketed in light of September 11th and believe that these weapons are an example of the gun industry exploiting an incredibly tragic situation solely for profit-making gains. And I should also mention that we have kicked off a billboard campaign in Los Angeles to counter similar advertisements run by an NRA affiliate in California called the California Rifle and Pistol Association, which is urging people to arm themselves for safety. Their billboards read, "Society is safer when criminals don't know who's armed." Our billboards will warn people about the dangers of bringing guns into people's homes. So there is an awful lot of activity now sparked by the gun manufacturers and gun industry to promote the sales of guns. This is incredibly alarming. And we were incredibly disappointed to hear John Ashcroft's statements last week before the Judiciary Committee. Here is an attorney general willing to change laws to give authorities access to records of all industries and covering all activities, but not to hand over gun records. And it seems to me that while they may say they're doing everything to keep Americans safe, they are, except where it comes to finding out if suspected terrorists have weapons. And it was a very, very alarming, I think, position for the Attorney General to take.
Paul Januzzo is also with us. He's vice president of Glock Handguns. Are handgun sales for Glock up since September 11th?
Yes, I think they're probably up between 15 and 20% since September 11th. Things were a little slow, like everything else in the economy beforehand.
And how do you account for that?
You know, you can only put the two things together. I've not heard of any studies, and I don't know of anyone that I've spoken to has attributed to anything specific. But obviously, you know, the tragedy on September 11th happened. Sometime thereafter, sales increased, so there's a connection of some sort.
Is Glock planning to release any kind of 911 special?
Yeah, we are. And much like Beretta, and contrary to what we just heard, nobody's profiting off it. In fact, our net will be considerably less because a sizable amount of the proceeds are going to go to the 9/11 fund, just like Beretta is doing.
What do you think of, say, a gun like the Tromex company's 50 caliber rifle called the Turban Chaser?
It sounds incredibly bad taste.
We're also joined in the studio by Alfredo Valentin, who is a board member of New Yorkers Against Gun Control, Against Gun Violence. His son Derek was killed in 1994 in the Bronx with his best friend. Can you talk about what happened?
In 1994, my son Derek and his best friend, Christopher Simmons, went to the corner of Allerton Avenue and Barnes in the Bronx. My son was being harassed by a bunch of kids, which started over a girl, not his girlfriend, but his girlfriend's cousins. He was being harassed to the point that he was going to have a fist fight with the kid. When they drove to Allerton Avenue and Barnes, my son and his best friend, Heath Christopher Simmons, stepped out of the car. A kid came out and said, buck him, which means shoot him if you listen to rap songs. And Heath was shot twice in the chest. My son was shot three times in the back as he tried to get away. The kid who shot my son was not the kid he was having the problem with. He was a kid who, I found out afterwards, had just bought a Saturday night special for $50, a gun that in this country it is illegal to import. In 1968, the Gun Control Act banned these guns from being imported, but they left out the American manufacturers took over, and my son got killed with a gun so illegal that Congress found it illegal to be imported into this country. I would never ask anyone not to buy a gun if they felt that a gun would make them feel safer. But I would also tell them this is a false sense of security. A gun is more likely to be used by them, their family member, or friend, 22 times more likely than it is against a criminal. Even police officers, something like 20% are shot with their own guns. What I would tell them is, unless you're an expert, what you're doing is putting yourself, your family, and your friends in danger. If the gun industry and Ashcroft really wanted to do something about guns, they wouldn't work so hard to defend the rights of the criminals to be able to get easy access to guns.
What do you think of gun sales going up after September 11th?
I just hope the tragedy, like what happened afterwards, where a three-year-old, a father who had bought a gun, and his three-year-old, I think it was son or daughter, was killed by it unintentionally. And I think this can happen again and again. The criminals are the ones that we should be stopping from getting guns, not making it easier. Those scared campaigns also tells them to buy guns and makes it easier when no one will question it so much because of the fact they're using fear to buy them.
Paul Januso of GLOCK.
Yeah.
I want to get your response.
You know, I understand what you said, and I feel very bad for him. You can't bring your children back, and I've got five children, and I can't imagine what would happen if one of them was taken from me like that. But, you know, there's just a whole lot of fiction there. The fact of the matter is, you know, criminals by definition don't obey the laws. So regardless of, you know, what gun laws there are out there, you know, it's intrinsic in the definition of the word. They're a criminal. They'll get a gun if they want one. They'll steal one from somebody. They'll drive a car through a window and, you know, do a crash and run. Somehow or another, they'll get their hands on it. And there isn't anybody out there trying to make gun laws less restrictive. I mean, Ashcroft's not trying to do it. The Bush administration isn't trying to do it. They're trying to push jail sentences for people that are using guns, you know, something that the Clinton administration, although did a lot of talking about, they let the prosecutors all over the country plead these things away for the last 10 years. I mean, that's just not reality.
Nan Aaron of Alliance for Justice Gun Industry Watch Project.
Well, if we want to talk about facts, let's talk about facts. A Glock gun was used in a shooting in Seattle, Washington, November 3rd, 1999, at North Lake Shipyard. Two dead, two wounded. What happened to the kids of those people who died? Xerox office building, Honolulu, Hawaii, November 2nd, 1999. Seven dead. Glock model 17 9mm pistol used. Atlanta, Georgia, July 29, 1999. Atlanta brokerage offices, 13 dead. 13 dead.
Ma'am, your logic is just so flawed. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous logic, ma'am. You're trying to blame a hammer for what the carpenter did. That's just nonsensical.
No, we're not.
It's ridiculous.
No, we're not.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
Glock is producing a deadly weapon.
Ma'am, weapons by definition are deadly. That's oxymoronic.
No, but these weapons will not make people safer. They do not. And will not honor the memory of victims of September 11th. They will only create new victims.
There are over 20 million guns in this country, ma'am. Obviously, there are a whole lot of...
20 million guns? Obviously, 30,000 people killed every year by guns in this
country. Obviously, there are a whole lot of them that aren't doing anything illegal, and they don't do anything by themselves. Put in the hands of a criminal, it is a very dangerous situation, no doubt about it.
Well, but
you can't penalize, you can't penalize the other 99.8% of the country for what criminals do.
Let me interrupt there and ask you, Paul Genuso, what do you think of John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, saying that FBI checks of the gun records of those people they detained since September 11th would violate their privacy? Paul Genuso of Glock.
Quite frankly, it's if we can detain them without a trial since September 11th, it seems to me that we've made the decision that they forfeited most of their rights already anyway, or that they didn't have any because they weren't citizens. So I don't understand the logic, frankly. I would like to say I have a lot of respect for Mr. Ashcroft, for Attorney General Ashcroft. I think he's a very intelligent man. I think he's very aware of a strict construction of the Constitution. But if it was my decision, frankly, I'd want to know. So I'm not sure what that's based in, and I'd really want to read more about it before I formed or expressed a firm opinion on it.
So you think that the FBI should have been allowed to check the gun records?
I would really like to read more about it. I mean, my gut reaction is if we can detain them for 3 months without a trial or without a hearing, then they don't have any rights. I mean, otherwise there's some sort of due process that would come into play and they'd be entitled to a hearing. So since we've already made that decision, it seems like I don't know why we can't check their records or their homes, for that matter, whatever.
Alfredo Valentin.
I believe criminals should be getting their guns through criminal methods, not through legitimate dealers. Like there was a study done by ATF where I believe it was 25,000 guns that were traced came from dealers. No, I'm sorry. It was 1% of the dealers, FFL dealers, represent that guns trace almost 50% of guns that were used in crimes. Gun shows was something like 25,000 guns recently in the last couple of years that were studied were also traced to criminals getting guns at gun shows. They shouldn't be getting their guns there. This is something that you people could stop.
If they're already a criminal and they have a record, it should be stopped. I mean, that's what background checks are about, and that's why we supported them. If if somebody comes in and they have a clean record at a gun store and they don't have a crime and they commit one thereafter, you know, the gun store owner certainly can't look into the future and determine that this person is a potential criminal. But if they have a criminal record, you're absolutely correct. There is no doubt in my mind either. They should be stopped.
Now, Aaron, what about this issue of gun fairs?
Of gun sales?
Fairs.
Oh. Well, obviously, we need to close the gun show loophole. Obviously, we need to take steps that will provide people, law enforcement agents, with the authority to monitor, to review, to investigate. We need stronger laws that will protect Americans, that will regulate guns. A recent study shows that terrorists using gun shows to buy weapons. It seems to me there is a need first and foremost. There's legislation pending before Congress. Harry Reid has legislation. Senator Lieberman and McCain have legislation. At the very least, we ought to support legislation to close the gun show loophole. It is not a gun show loophole. It is right now a terrorist loophole. And that should be closed.
I would
right
love
now.
To have you fax
everyone
me a copy of that
in America,
report. I'd like to see, I'd
America.
Love to have you fax me a copy
we
of that report because
you
you're absolutely
that
making
show,
that up
that
out of thin
study.
Air. The report that showed terrorists are getting their guns at gun shows.
Paul Genuso, do you feel that the climate is better for the gun industry since September 11th in Congress?
I don't know. I don't believe so at all.
What will the gun that Glock puts out be called?
Don't know. We haven't decided yet. As I told your the person on your show when they called yesterday, it's something that we're still debating. You know, if we do 2,000 of them, we figure we can get another $100,000 to $200,000 up to the 9/11 fund. And as I said, our net on it would be less. We sell every gun we make right now anyway, so it's not like it's going to increase our sales. It's going to take away from other sales. But you know, if we can get another contribution up there, which we've already made one, then we'd like to do that. We supply New York City with 26,000 guns for their police officers.
Alfredo Valentin, I'm going to give you the last word, having come into our firehouse studio from the Bronx, where your son was killed.
The World Trade Center, some 3,000 people were killed. That's about every month and a half, people, that amount of people die from gun debt. As a parent who felt the loss, I can only tell people that if you do not pay attention to the issues that we're discussing and why gun control is important and should only be in the hands of decent people, not criminals, you will find out one day that it will not be me who's speaking, but maybe you.
How old was your son, Derek?
17.
I want to thank Alfredo Valentin of New Yorkers Against Gun Violence, Nan Aaron of the Alliance for Justice Gun Industry Watch Project, and Paul Genuso, Vice President of Glock Handguns. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Lou Gehrig's disease. The Pentagon now admits that Gulf War vets are up to three times more likely to contract this illness. Stay with us.
Sooner or later, it comes down to fate. I might as well be the one. Well, they showed you a statue, told you to pray. They built you a temple and locked you away. Ah, but they never told you the price that you pay. The things that you might have done. Only the good die. Send up a signal, I'll throw you the line. Stained glass curtain you're hiding behind. Never lets in the sun. Darling, only the good die young.
Only the good die young. I'm Amy Goodman. This is the War and Peace Report. After years of denying any link between illness and service in the Persian Gulf War, military officials said this week that Gulf War vets are nearly twice as likely to suffer from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, as other soldiers. So far, at least 40 veterans have been diagnosed with the disease, which causes severe muscle wasting and is typically fatal in 2 to 5 years. The Department of Veterans Affairs said it would immediately offer disability and survivor benefits to veterans with the disease who served in the Persian Gulf War. But the admission that service in the Gulf has been linked to ALS has only raised more questions for more than 100,000 Gulf War vets whose illnesses have yet to be diagnosed or even acknowledged by the U.S. government. Just a little while ago, I reached Tom Donnelly, who's the father of Michael Donnelly, a Gulf War fighter pilot who was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease in 1996. He just joins us on the line, as well as Steve Robinson, who's executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center. He was on a train on the way to the Bureau of Veterans Affairs, where he was going to be talking about the issue of disease and veterans. But I started by asking him if the Pentagon's announcement comes as a surprise to him.
No, it does not. Gulf War veterans have known for a long time that the reasons why they were sick would be found out if good scientific research was conducted. This study is a result of a 10-year effort, basically, of Gulf War veterans pressing the issue. This is the third study into ALS whereby finally some good scientific results were produced. No, it's not a surprise to us. We expect more to come.
Steve Robinson, you served with the Special Forces immediately following the Gulf War. providing humanitarian medical assistance to repatriate the Kurds. What happened to you after that?
Well, I really don't know, as some Gulf War veterans can't really pinpoint the exact time that something happened to them. I just know for a fact that I operated in and around an area where Saddam Hussein has been known to have gassed his own people. We were in that area without any protection. Obviously, the environment there is very dangerous and hazardous. And so shortly after the war, a couple of years later, I noticed changes in my physical condition, in joints, rashes, different things that I attributed to age. But I later found out that many of my friends who had also been to the Gulf were experiencing the same thing and worse, and some of them in very debilitating ways. I'm not really sure what happened, but I do know that I am amongst a company of many people that, that have a variety of diseases and illnesses as a result of their service.
For a long time now, it's been known that Gulf War veterans have been sicker than most people who are at that age and have done service. What about the issue of Lou Gehrig's disease?
I think Mr. Donnelly should really respond to that. They've been at the forefront of actually fighting this issue. Mr. Donnelly?
Yeah, well, Amy, our view has been almost from the beginning of Michael's illness, and he himself formulated this theory that having flown through the atmosphere above Iraq and Kuwait in areas where the coalition forces bombed chemical weapons storage and manufacturing facilities, that he was exposed to a series of low doses of nerve agent. Nerve gas is a chemical known as organophosphate poison. Michael's onset of symptoms in 1995-96 was triggered by a gross exposure at Shepherd Air Force Base in Texas to malathion, which is a commonly used insecticide, which is also an organophosphate poison. Malathion kills insects the way nerve gas kills people. I'm convinced that more research and study will ultimately prove that most of these folks with ALS and others with other neurological diseases, maybe including Steve, I don't know, it will be found that these are traceable to the body absorbing and storing organophosphate poisons or others, that at a certain point in the physiology of a given individual tips over from symptoms into illness. And that's what we got here.
How did the military deal with your son, Michael Donnelly?
Well, he was on active duty when these symptoms emerged. He returned from the Gulf, flew one tour at Tampa, and then was assigned to Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls. And he was on active duty when the symptoms appeared and when he was diagnosed. And he was medically retired. The service at first wished to retire him temporarily at 50% disability. And we took an appeal to an appeals board that's built into the system. And they saw the light of day and gave him permanent retirement at 100% disability. Within the diagnostic box known as ALS, Michael has gotten all the benefits to which he reasonably could be entitled. I've got to say that the VA, within that set of limitations, has been very forthcoming, very good. These people here in Connecticut have been excellent for Michael. The problem is not Michael, and the reason he got into this fight was not because of his own lack of benefits, but because he knew that there were others out there similarly diagnosed, but diagnosed after release from active duty, who were being totally stiffed. The service connection was denied, and there are some horror stories that I don't even want to think about to tell you about young people who are now deceased, who came down with the same disease and got nothing. No help for their families, no nothing. That's a horrible story, but true. Michael, I think, is very, very pleased and proud that he was able finally to cause this to happen, which he did. Michael is the guy behind this.
Now, you have said that after he ran through the Malathion at Shepherd's Air Force Base, a doctor at first said that he was going to get sick, but then said that there was no link.
Well, not even that he's going to get sick. They trotted out what became the standard line in the service and in the VA. Quote, there is no study that shows a link between Gulf War service and any illness, unquote. And they all tried to suggest to him that it was stress-related. And that's been the mantra up until Secretary Principe's press conference 2 days ago. That's been the mantra of the establishment. It's stress-related, which is, to people close to it, so obviously wrong as to be obscene.
Steve Robinson, you have dealt with many, many vets at the National Gulf War Resource Center. Can you talk about how their experiences compared to Tom Donnelly's son, Michael Donnelly, the F-16 fighter pilot who now has Lou Gehrig's?
Yeah, I'd also like to say that not only do I deal with them there, but I dealt with them while I was on active duty. As you may be aware, I came from the Office of the Special Assistant for Gulf War Illnesses as a military intelligence analyst and investigator looking at Gulf War illness issues. While I was there, after going to different town hall meetings and briefings, and looking at the overwhelming evidence that Gulf War veterans themselves presented, and then comparing what DOD was doing in terms of the investigation, I felt compelled that once I retired and knew that I wasn't going to be in any jeopardy, that I would come into this work. I'm not at all pleased at what DOD has done in terms of the investigation, and that's an issue we're going to look at in the future and talk about. But to get to your question, I am burdened by, as probably Tom is, with meeting thousands of Gulf War veterans who are seeking benefits, and these people are they're losing their jobs, their marriages are breaking up, just multitudes of problems, and they're not receiving the type of care and benefits that they're due as a result of their service in the Gulf War. So this study is promising to me in that for the first time we've got an independent organization outside of DOD doing a study that actually produced a result, and that result is you're two times more likely to have this very rare disease if you deployed to the Gulf War. Now, to Southwest Asia, if you use that methodology and start looking at diseases that Gulf War veterans face across the board as a result of service in the Gulf War, I believe we're going to find that we're more likely to have a higher GPL than the normal population for diseases also there.
And when you say GPL?
General population limit.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, in the United States, we were two times higher in Southwest Asia to likely develop ALS as those people here in the United States because of our service.
Can you talk about how you convinced the doctor to do the study on Lou Gehrig's disease?
I wish I could explain how. I'm very grateful that it happened. Let me just tell you that briefly that our family, Michael, his wife Susan, my wife Ray, and our daughter Denise, met together in Boston at a medical seminar where Dr. Feusner of the VA agreed to meet with us for 30 minutes. He spent more than 2 hours with us. And from that meeting emerged the decision to conduct this study, and I'm very grateful that he did it. Incidentally, I must tell you something else. The press release and the reports to me from reporters to whom I've spoken who were present at the press conference, where, in addition to Secretary Principe, other members of the Veterans Affairs Department spoke, there's still confusion about the numbers. I mean, the 40 number, one of the reporters asked them to break that number down by branch of service, and they did. I don't remember the numbers that are quoted, but between Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps, the total number that they gave out for each service added up to 43, not 40.
Right.
clearly, they're still not able to bring themselves to tell the total truth about everything, even though they do the right thing. And that's amazing, but there it is. I mean, I don't believe 40 is the answer. I don't believe 43 is the answer. But whatever it is, at least it's been admitted that there's double the likelihood of the incidence of this disease in this body. Incidentally, from a public health point of view, there's another important thing here. If the cumulative effect theory is in any way valid, there are other Gulf War vets out there who are at risk for sustaining that one final insult that pushes them over the edge into disease. If there is any credence to any validity to that theory at all, they ought to be warned about the risk.
Yeah.
I've been saying that for years and nobody listens.
Steve Robinson, would you like to elaborate on that from the National Gulf War Resource Center?
Yeah, I would. He's absolutely right that there's cumulative effects. An important thing about, I was actually at the press release, both upstairs with the Veterans Service Organization, where we were told in advance of the press being told. And one of the things that was immediately evident was you would have expected them to have been prepared to discuss the full breakout of those personnel who had been exposed. An interesting sidebar to the number 40 that they gave that wasn't talked about in the press conference is that there are about 15 or 20 people that they identified as having ALS diagnosis through civilian doctors, and those people would not participate in the VA study because they were concerned that if they received the diagnosis of ALS, they would somehow lose benefits. So Tom is exactly right that the numbers are much higher and that we still do not know how many people were exposed or do have this disease.
Let me explain a little bit of element of what Steve said.
Michael,
Amy?
Tom Donnelly, yes.
There was such a push over the years to get benefits to people who were sick, obviously sick, and whose service, quite obviously to some, was the cause, that Congress a couple of years ago approved a statutory change that permitted the VA to give benefits to veterans who exhibited symptoms but who had an undiagnosed illness, quote, undiagnosed illness. Well, some of the good-hearted VA doctors who knew they were dealing with an ALS case changed the diagnosis to undiagnosed so they could get benefits. Now, these fellas are running the risk by engaging in this study of changing that back from undiagnosed to ALS and losing benefits. Fortunately, what Secretary Principe did will now prevent that unhappy result. But that's why they wouldn't participate in the study, and who could blame them? So there are lots more than 40, believe me.
Tom Donnelly, can you describe what your son suffers from now in terms of what he's going through physically?
Well, this guy is an amazing man. He is totally immobile. He can't move a limb or a digit. The only control he has of muscular control is his eyeballs. He can move his eyes around, and that's how we communicate. He, for nutrition, is totally dependent on a stomach feed tube, and for respiration, he's been supported by a ventilator for a year now since he had a tracheotomy.
Tom Donnelly, father of Michael Donnelly, Gulf War fighter pilot, diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease in 1996, and Steve Robinson, executive director of the National Gulf War Resource Center. Thank you both very much for joining us. And that does it for the program. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner, Suganya Mahendran, Matthew Power. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland at the helm at WBIX.org. We're broadcasting at Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of Dish Network, also on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and Exile from the Embattled Studios, the WBAI Studios of the Band and the Fired, studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! in Exile.
The domestic response that we have now witnessed to the war against Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda has little to do with a struggle to combat terrorism or protect the American people than a pretext, a justification for the construction of what I believe to be a national security state.
Manning Marable on globalization, race, and war. We'll look at the Bush administration and corporate America pushing for billions in tax rebates in the name of fighting terrorism, and talk to a garment worker and former mayoral candidate in Miami, fired from his job for making anti-war statements. He was making American flags. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. U.S. bombing raids in the eastern Tora Bora mountain range are continuing despite an al-Qaeda offer to surrender, according to Western news sources. The fighters had agreed to surrender by early today. The deadline passed. But the Afghan Islamic Press and a spokesman for a U.S.-backed Afghan commander both say the fighters are asking to be handed over to the United Nations in the presence of diplomats from their respective countries. The spokesman said if the fighters didn't surrender within a couple hours, they would be killed. NBC News is reporting that hundreds of Taliban and al-Qaeda troops, including many of their remaining leaders, have escaped from Afghanistan into neighboring Iran and Pakistan. U.S. officials believe that almost all the remaining top 22 Taliban leaders have escaped into Pakistan, mostly on foot or horseback over remote mountain trails. Meanwhile, as many as 500 Taliban and al-Qaeda troops captured in the northern cities of Mazar-i-Sharif and Kunduz have bought safe passage into Iran. Soldiers from the U.S. 10th Mountain Division are patrolling the areas along the Pakistani border, while Pakistan said it sent 4,000 troops to the area. A federal grand jury in Virginia handed up the first criminal charges in the September 11th attacks yesterday. The charges allege a French citizen in U.S. custody was trained and funded by Osama bin Laden's network and was part of the conspiracy to crash jetliners into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Following a contentious debate among senior government officials, the White House on Monday decided to try Zacharias Moussaoui in civilian court rather than a secret military tribunal. Senior Pentagon officials and other administration officials had lobbied vigorously last month to make Moussaoui to be tried by an overseas tribunal. But after heated criticism over the use of tribunals, the Bush administration reached a compromise that would permit the trial to be held in an open criminal court, but in a jurisdiction with a strong record of imposing the death penalty. President Bush will soon tell Russia that the U.S. will withdraw from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty. The Russians had hoped to preserve the treaty, which they see as a foundation of strategic stability and cornerstone of arms control agreements hammered out over the past 30 years. U.S. withdrawal, many defense experts have warned, could risk soured relations with Russia, strained ties with NATO allies, an arms buildup by China, and an unraveling of other international accords. In a speech at the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina yesterday, President Bush used the September 11th attacks to justify breaking the treaty. He said, quote, suppose the Taliban and the terrorists had been able to strike America or important allies with a ballistic missile. Our coalition would have become fragile. We must protect America and her friends against all forms of terror, including the terror that could arrive on a missile. Driving Bush to act on the treaty now, officials say, is the fact that an expanded Pentagon plan of missile defense testing and development already has begun straining the accord. Israeli helicopter gunships attacked the Palestinian Authority's National Security Building in Gaza last night, killing four Palestinian civilians, injuring some 20 others. The building's located in a residential part of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Witnesses said the gunships also hit an adjacent refugee camp and said there were a large number of victims because the attack coincided with the end of evening prayers. House and Senate negotiators yesterday agreed on a far-reaching education plan that would dramatically expand student testing and hold schools responsible for closing the achievement gap separating many poor and minority students and their middle-class and white peers. Approval of the plan, which had been stalled in congressional negotiations since summer, clears the way for final action on the measure within a week. And on the home front, Pacifica National Programming Director Eutrice Lead has resigned. lead as the X Talk Show host from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. She was installed as interim general manager close to a year ago in what has been dubbed the Christmas coup at WBAI, with late night lock changes and the termination of longtime staffers Bernard White, Sharon Harper, and Valerie Van Isler. What ensued was mass bannings and firings, along with the installation of a high-tech security surveillance system and a precipitous drop in listenership and donors. Democracy Now! Staff was forced out under lead in August out of WBAI. She was then promoted to the network's second highest management position, National Programming Director. Again, according to a memo from the executive director of Pacifica, Utrice Lead has resigned.
We see it, you take it. Oh, made me wanna holler the way they do my life. Made me wanna holler the way they do my life. This ain't living, this ain't living. No, no, baby, this ain't living. No, 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 no. Inflation, no change. To increase finance, bills pile up, sky high, send that boy off.
Inner City Blues, Marvin Gaye here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is what some of the biggest corporations in the U.S. would have received in tax rebates under the so-called economic stimulus plan that for the last month has been pushed by the Bush administration in the name of fighting terrorism. IBM, $1.4 billion. Ford, $1 billion. General Motors, $833 million, GE, $660 million, Enron, $250 million. In the wake of the September 11th attacks, the Bush administration and major corporations have launched an aggressive effort to push through a host of business-friendly measures wrapped in the guise of fighting terrorism. If we're to believe the pitch, drilling in the Arctic, fast-track treaty authority, massive tax cuts are now vital measures to preserve our national security. The Republican version of so-called economic stimulus, a $100 billion package of tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy that one public interest group dubbed the Campaign Contributors War Profiteering Act of 2001, includes a repeal of the alternative minimum tax, which was passed in the 1980s after major corporations exploited massive loopholes to avoid paying taxes. The Democratic version of the bill would be tilted towards spending to help the poor and those unemployed since September 11th. Congress is set to decide on a compromise version of the bill this week, setting up a stark choice between the needs of major corporations and those rendered most vulnerable since the September 11th attacks. We're joined on the telephone from Washington by Robert McIntyre, who's the director of Citizens for Tax Justice. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hi, how are you?
It's good to have you with us. So, can you just explain in simple terms what the alternative minimum tax is?
Well, simply put, if a company has so many loopholes that despite making lots of money, it doesn't owe hardly anything in income taxes, then there's an alternative tax that says you still have to pay some reasonable amount if you're making a lot of money. And that's pretty much how it works.
And that was passed during the Reagan-Bush years?
It was adopted in 1986 as part of the Tax Reform Act in Reagan's second term, when he decided that what he did in his first term hadn't worked out.
So that the companies would have to pay some, however small, amount of tax each year?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it nominally can be as much as 10% of their profits. Often it's less, though.
So it's now, what, some 15 years later?
Right.
And what is the Bush administration pushing? Not only repealing this, but giving the money back?
Right. The plan that the House passed and the president supported would repeal the minimum tax so that these companies could go back to not paying much of anything in taxes, and in addition give them back all the minimum taxes they've paid for the last 15 years right away as a check from the Treasury. So it'd be a check, you know, how you got your $600 or $300 rebate last fall. Well, IBM would get a $1.4 billion check and so forth.
Is this what the corporations have been pushing for? I mean, did this go beyond even their wildest expectations?
Well, no, they've been pushing for something like this ever since the minimum tax was adopted. A lot of them were very happy to be avoiding all of their tax liabilities, and they'd like to go back to the what they think are the good old days, and a lot of us think are the bad old days. And this is just, you know, the tip of the iceberg in the House bill, by the way. There's a whole bunch of other business tax breaks that over the first 3 years, the House bill was $212 billion in total, and three-quarters of that was for corporate tax breaks.
So tell us what happened last night.
Last night? You mean with the negotiations?
Yes.
Nobody's quite sure what's going on there. Both sides are trying to position themselves so they don't look too bad if this falls apart. The Democrats are continuing to insist that the bill be directed at stimulating consumer spending and as a added benefit, helping those who have been hurt by the recession and by the terrorist attacks. And the Republicans are insisting that it not be short-term, that it have long-term effects that will make our budget problems even worse and be directed at corporations. And they're not getting that close together yet, so we'll see what happens.
I'm looking at an AP report, and it says Senator John Breaux, the Democrat of Louisiana, said after a Tuesday night meeting between a group of centrist senators and Bush at the White House that the president's proposal could be a basis for a compromise that hopefully a significant number of Democrats could support with a significant number of Republicans. The revised White House proposal, which reflects many of the Democrats' priorities, scales back the president's proposed tax cuts, increases aid to the jobless, including assistance with health insurance, with popular business tax breaks included. It could cost $93 billion in 2002. Bush planned to put the package on the table today at a meeting with top four congressional leaders, including Daschle. Many Democrats continue to oppose accelerating the effective dates of income tax cuts passed earlier this year.
They really haven't changed it very much. It's window dressing mostly. They've got essential repeal of the minimum tax still in the bill. They've got these big increase in business write-offs over the next 3 years that will cost more than $100 billion just for that one item. They're still speeding up the rate cuts as the House bill did, so not a lot of movement on their part.
What is it that you see most egregious in this, what's called an economic stimulus package?
Well, I mean, the big picture, I think, is the most egregious in the sense that this isn't very stimulative. They spend a great deal of money, but all of it goes to corporations in the hope, they say, that companies will buy some more machinery. Well, our problem now is that companies have a lot of machinery they're not using because we have overcapacity. And the way you deal with that problem is to stimulate consumer demand. So just giving the money to the companies and hoping they might buy some machines they won't even plug in doesn't make very much economic sense. And then the second problem is, you know, everybody agreed after September 11th we needed to do something to help the people who were hurt by the recession and the attacks. And all of a sudden that seems to be out the window largely for the House Republicans and the president. They give lip service to it. They talk about it, but they don't really put any money behind it.
In what ways do you see a space for people to weigh in at this point?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is that they are not trying to sell the Republicans or their stimulus package by what it really is. They keep trying to pretend it's something else because they know the public doesn't like the idea of turning this stimulus bill into another round of upper income and corporate tax cuts. So the one thing the public can do is keep reminding the politicians that they do know what's going on, and that will, I think, keep them in check.
Well, I want to thank you, Bob McIntyre, very much for being with us. What do you see as a timetable for the voting on this plan? The Republicans call it economic stimulus, group of public interest groups calling it Campaign Contributors War Profiteering Act of 2001.
If they don't get something done this week, it's going to be put off till next year, I think. And I don't know whether they will or not.
Bob McIntyre, Director of Citizens for Tax Justice, the website www.ctj.org. We're going to take an early break. When we come back, Manning Marable on war, globalization, and race. Stay with us. Star here on the War and Peace Report, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In the first criminal indictment related to the September 11th attacks, a federal grand jury charged a French Moroccan with multiple conspiracy counts. Zacharias Moussaoui is 33 years old, jailed August 17th on immigration charges in Minnesota, where he'd raised suspicions by seeking flight lessons. He'll be arraigned on January 2nd in Alexandria, Virginia, and faces trial in federal court, not before a military tribunal. If convicted, he could get the death penalty. A number of countries, particularly European Union countries, have said that they will not extradite suspects to the United States if they face military tribunals or the death penalty. Today, we're going to talk about the war abroad and the war at home by listening to a speech by Manning Marable, Director of African American Studies at Columbia University here in New York. Among his other books, How Capitalism Underdeveloped America, Problems in Race, Political Economy, and Society, he spoke at a conference on globalization and resistance at the City University of New York. This is Professor Manning Marable.
There are two great strategic tasks that are required for social justice movements, and especially for the left and activists of color today in the United States, especially in the wake of 9/11. The first is to make the political connections between class inequality, neoliberalism, and the accelerating racialization of U.S. society. That is, to make the connections between institutionalized racial oppression and how it manifests itself in things like mass incarceration, the dismantling of nearly all public institutions that low-income and working people depend upon, like schools and public health clinics, and the declining standard of living for most working families, regardless of their race or ethnicity. We need to ask hard questions like how does school privatization and the dismantling of public welfare and social assistance accelerate class inequality and racialization. The second task in the aftermath of 9/11 is for us to make, as progressives and as the left and as activists of color, to make a direct connection between globalization, racism, and war. The domestic response that we have now witnessed to the war against Afghanistan and Al-Qaeda has little to do with a struggle to combat terrorism or protect the American people than a pretext, a justification for the construction of what I believe to be a national security state, a structure of state power for neoliberalism, because neoliberalism is hostile to democracy. It needs a neo-authoritarian state structure in order to carry it out its domestic and global economic agenda. And so this afternoon, I'd like to focus on issues of class inequality. That is to say, an anti-globalization movement must speak a language of class, that is, class matters. It must not be reserved or reluctant to say that globalization is indeed imperialism. It must not be reluctant to use a Marxian political economic analysis to point to the increased racialization of U.S. society, the growth of the prison industrial complex, as processes that flow logically from a political economy in which 1% of a total U.S. of 1% of a total population in our country has a greater combined net wealth than 94% of the country. In other words, racialization and inequality flow out of who owns what within the society, and anti-globalization must speak that kind of language. Secondly, we need to talk in about the domestic political implications of 9/11. We need an anti-globalization politics that does speak to this use of war as a pretext to the construction of a national security state. And finally, we need to have an anti-globalization politics that sees the importance of positioning ourselves politically from the vantage point of the Third World, that of the underdeveloped South, rather than from the perspective of the First World, the U.S. and Western Europe. The anti-globalization mass movement must ground itself into the daily lives, that is, articulate the lived experiences of the 2 billion people on this planet who are hungry and malnourished, and the 3 billion people on this planet who are illiterate. It must not be a movement of privilege, but rather a movement that sees the world not from the top down, but from the bottom up. If we look inside of the United States and see what the implications are to globalization, we can observe that many of the most serious problems that we find within our cities today, the underfunded schools, deteriorating public transportation, the closed libraries, the public health clinics shut down, are all generated and driven by class inequality. During the last 2 decades, the real wages of most U.S. workers at the bottom 60% of the population stagnated or fell. Now, this is during a period of so-called massive economic boom, an unprecedented economic expansion in U.S. history. Most of the increase of the wealth in the last 20 years has gone to the wealthiest 1% of U.S. households. Wage inequality in the United States is today at an unprecedented level. Now, how does this get played out in cities or communities across the country? Well, here in New York City, during the 1990s, a period of economic expansion, low-wage workers' salaries actually fell nearly 10% in this city. The class inequality gap in New York City is widening. This is before the 2001 economic recession. According to the Fiscal Policy Institute in New York City, the average incomes of the richest 20% in 2000 were 20 times greater than the poorest 20% of families in the 1990s. In other words, millions of U.S. families earn more money than they did in 1990, but they cannot afford decent housing. 3 million households have critical housing needs. 76% spend more than one half of their incomes on housing. About 500,000 Americans live in homeless shelters or on the streets on any given night in the year 2001. Roughly 2 million people are homeless at some time every year during the late 90s and the early 21st century. Now that we have entered the worst recession since the 1974-75 recession, and millions of women and children of color and working poor people are becoming more vulnerable than ever before. When the 60-year-old federal safety net was destroyed and discarded, several million women and children saw their incomes in the late 90s plummet. In 1994, about three-fourths of those eligible for food stamps were receiving them. By the end of the decade, it fell to nearly 50%. About half of all families on temporary assistance for needy families periodically go without food. About 40% currently lack health coverage. This escalating inequality has had a direct impact upon the growing numbers of poor and racialized minorities in our prisons. We see the economic consequences of class inequality through racialization and mass incarceration. During the period from 1980 to 2000, the combined expenditures for state, federal, and local governments on police increased 400%. Corrections expenditures for building new prisons, upgrading existing facilities, hiring more guards, and related costs increased 1,000%. Now, the greatest victims of mass incarceration and racialization and class inequality are, of course, Latino and Black young people in this racialized U.S. society. In April 2000, utilizing national and state data compiled by the FBI, the Justice Department issued a comprehensive survey documenting these racial disparities in the dynamics of mass incarceration in the prison industrial complex. African Americans under the age of 18 comprise 15% of their national age group, yet they currently comprise 26% of those who are arrested. Now, after entering the criminal justice system, Black and white juveniles with the identical records are treated in fundamentally different ways. According to the study, among white youthful offenders, 66% are referred to juvenile courts, while only 31% of all African American youth are taken there. Blacks comprise 44% of those detained in juvenile jails, 46% of all those tried in adult criminal courts, and 58% of all juveniles who are warehoused in adult prisons. In practical terms, this means that African Americans who are arrested and charged for a crime, that they are more than 6 times more likely to be assigned to prison than white youthful offenders. For young people who have never been to prison before, African Americans are 9 times more likely than whites to be sentenced to juvenile prisons. And for youths charged with drug offenses, Black youths are 48 times more likely than white youths to be sentenced to juvenile prisons. 48 times. We take a look at Sing Sing Prison or any prison throughout this state, and what we see is 94% of all admissions in Sing Sing, and about 92% statewide, of all prisoners currently incarcerated in New York State prisons for drug offenses around the Rockefeller drug laws, nonviolent drug offenders, are Black and Latino, 94%. Today, there are over 2 million Americans incarcerated. And while the racialization aspect of this should be an issue we focus on in a globalization from below politics, It is imperative for us to see the class dynamic of this as well. About one-third of all prisoners were unemployed at the time of their arrests. Only 55% of all prisoners held full-time jobs in the year prior to their arrest. About 70% of all prisoners in state and federal penitentiaries earned less than $15,000 a year prior to their arrest. In other words, our prisons have become the chief means of warehousing the unemployed, racialized minorities, the unskilled, and the poor. A globalization from below must speak to mass incarceration, the prison industrial complex, and make the link between class inequality and racialization and privatization. There can be no privatization in a neoliberal capitalist private market-based economy without racialization. Racialization and privatization are part of the same dynamic. And an anti-globalization movement must speak to the political economy of race and gender and class in an effective way. Second point. Now, several weeks ago in the New York Times, I'm going to run out of time if I don't wrap this up. All right, I'm going to skip the second section. I'm sorry, because I want to get to this third point about viewing. No, okay. Well, all right, then I'll go ahead. Okay. Several weeks ago in the New York Times, Clyde Haberman, right, wrote this piece that I want to talk a little bit about on this second point of the domestic implications of the politics post 9/11. Haberman writes, there is, quote, a connection between the emotional rubble of the World Trade Center nightmare and Amadou Diallo. You remember Amadou, the unarmed West African immigrant gunned down with 41 shots by the NYPD Street Crimes Unit. This is what Haberman wrote, quote, it is quite possible that America will have to decide, and fairly soon, how much license it wants to give law enforcement agencies to stop ordinary people at airports and border crossings, to question them at length about where they have been and where they're going and what they intend to do once they get where they're going. It would be probably no surprise if ethnic profiling enters the equation. Now, Haberman reluctantly acknowledged that Giuliani, quote, may be an authoritarian at heart. Maybe. But then he adds, quote, as a wounded New York mourns its unburied dead and turns to its mayor for solace. Public concerns about civil rights and civil liberties violations would necessarily recede. In other words, he implies that the rights of people like Amadou Diallo, he implies that the rights of racialized minorities and people from low-income and unemployed neighborhoods, the rights of those people of color in this city are somehow secondary or tertiary to the personal safety of the white upper middle class. Now, as the national media has picked up the drumbeat on the war on terrorism, we've seen the implications of a politics of globalization and neoliberalism here at home, the rise of neo-authoritarianism. New York State legislature, in the span of a week, created a new crime, quote-unquote, terrorism, with a maximum penalty of life imprisonment. Anyone convicted of giving more than $1,000 to any organization defined by state authorities as terrorist will face up to 15 years in state prison. Now, when you think for a minute that it was not too many years ago that the African National Congress was a terrorist organization, and when you think only for a few seconds that the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, is still defined as a terrorist organization, the danger of suppressing any activities by U.S. citizens that support third world liberation movements now has become all too clear and all too real. We will soon see, if we haven't already, dissident profiling, the proliferation of electronic surveillance, roving wiretapping, harassment at the workplace, the infiltration and disruption of anti-war groups, the stigmatization of any critics of U.S. Militarism as disloyal and subversive. What the anti-globalization movement in this country needs to say, and say loudly, is you cannot preserve democracy by restricting and eliminating democratic rights. To publicly oppose the government's policies, which one knows to be morally bankrupt and politically ridiculous, is expressing the strongest belief and faith in the principles of democracy. And that's what we should be saying. We must clearly explain to the American people that missile strikes and indiscriminate carpet bombings we are unleashing against peasants in Afghanistan will not make us safer. The policies of the Bush regime actually put our lives in greater danger, because the use of government-sponsored terror will not halt brutal retaliations by the terrorists. The national security state apparatus that we are busily constructing today is designed primarily to suppress domestic dissent. Third point. The bombing campaign against the people of Afghanistan, I believe, in history will be described by the phrase, the U.S. against the Third World. The United States government cannot engage in effective multilateral actions against international terrorism because its own behavior illustrates its complete contempt for international cooperation. The United States owed $582 million in back dues to the United Nations and only paid up when, after 9/11 attacks, jeopardized its own national security. Republican conservatives demand that the United States should be exempt from the jurisdiction of an international criminal court. For the 2001 World Conference Against Racism, the U.S. government authorized an allocation of a paltry $250,000 versus $12 million it gave to the Beijing Conference for Women in 1995. Now, the U.S. media and opinion makers have repeatedly gone out of their way to twist the facts on these issues. For three decades, the U.S. refused to ratify the 1965 U.N. Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racism and xenophobia. Is it any wonder that much of the Third World questions U.S. motives? The carpet bombing of the Taliban seems to the Third World to have a lot less to do with the suppression of terrorism and a lot more to do with securing future petroleum product rights inside of Central Asia. Exxon, Mobil, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler, they are bigger combined in terms of their combined wealth than the gross domestic products of 182 countries. In fact, of the world's largest 100 economies, 49 are countries and 51 are corporations. How do we see the events from the Third World perspective? There's a direct linkage between the events of September the 11th and the politics that occurred in Durban at the World Conference Against Racism. The U.S. government in Durban opposed the definition of slavery as a crime against humanity. It refused to acknowledge the historical and contemporary effects of colonialism, racial segregation, and apartheid on the underdevelopment and oppression of the non-European world. It polemically manipulated charges of anti-Semitism to evade and avoid discussions concerning the rights of Palestinian people to self-determination. The world's subaltern masses represented at Durban sought to advance a new global dialogue about the political economy of race globally, and the United States insulted the entire global community. Should we be surprised, therefore, that Palestinian children celebrate in the streets of their occupied territories when they see televised images of our largest buildings being destroyed? should we be shocked that hundreds of protest marches in opposition to the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan are being held throughout the world. The vast majority of dark humankind is saying to the U.S. that racism, war, and militarism are not the solution to the world's major problems. Transnational corporate capitalism and repressive neoliberal policies of structural adjustment represent a dead end for the developing world. We can only end the threat of terrorism by addressing constructively the routine violence of poverty, the routine violence of hunger, the routine violence of class exploitation, characterizing the daily existence of billions of people on the planet Earth. Racism is, after all, in the final analysis, only another form of violence. To stop the violence of terror and war, we must also stop the violence of racism and class inequality. To struggle for peace, to find new paths toward reconciliation, both domestically and globally, is the only way to safeguard our cities, the United States, our country, and ourselves from the violence of terror and the dangers of war. Because without the fight for justice, and without justice, there will never be and can never be any peace. Thank you.
Professor Manning Marable, Director of African American Studies at Columbia University in New York. Among his other books, How Capitalism Underdeveloped America, Problems in Race, Political Economy, and Society. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll hear from a man who worked in a factory that made American flags in Miami, run by Goodwill Industries. He was fired after saying publicly he opposed the bombing of Afghanistan. Stay with us.
Our precious right to not be shown. The gory deeds we do. We won't admit to nothing. Oh, glory is the truth. We're banking on the flag to protect us from the world, to save us from the hatred.
Peter Quick, Counting on the Flag, a song for the patriotic, a listener who sent in his music. And you can let us know about yours as well. You can send us email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The flag, what does it stand for? Well, yesterday on the program, we heard the story of Katie Sierra, a 15-year-old high school student from Charleston, West Virginia, suspended for wearing a T-shirt to school on which she'd written, "When I saw the dead and dying Afghani children on TV, I felt a newly recovered sense of national security. God bless America." School board members even accused Katie of treason for her anti-war views. And she is now suspended from school. She's suing the school and she's homeschooling. Well, the assault on free speech extends from the workplace, from school to the workplace. In Miami, Florida recently, a man who worked in a factory that made American flags was fired for stating publicly he opposed the bombing of Afghanistan. He joins us now in our Firehouse studio in New York. His name is Michael Attali. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you. Good morning.
So tell us your story.
Well, I was a candidate for mayor, as you stated, in Miami. The elections held about 1 month ago. I was the Socialist Workers Party candidate, and in my campaign, I was speaking out on a number of issues, speaking against the bombing and the troops being sent to Afghanistan. I believe the U.S. government is taking advantage of the events at the World Trade Center to expand its military and economic domination of the region. I was speaking in defense of unions, ability of workers to organize on the job, in defense of the Cuban Revolution. And I appeared in a candidate's debate on October 18th, which was televised, which opened up the subsequent events in which I was fired from my job. I appeared on the TV explaining my point of view on these issues. The next 2 days, for the first time ever, supervisors started coming up to me on the job, asking me, what are your views? What party are you with? Questions like this. I don't like talking to my supervisors about politics, so I just said, you know, it's hard to work and talk at the same time. So then they asked if I'd like to go out to lunch with them, and I said, no, thank you, I have other things to do. 2 days after that, I started work as usual at 7 in the morning at Goodwill. Goodwill is about 500 people workforce making military uniforms, flags, etc. I start at 7 o'clock in the morning as usual as my at my machine. At 5 o'clock in the afternoon, about 1/2 hour before quitting time, the top supervisor says you're needed in personnel. So I go to personnel, and waiting for me there is the head of security. And he has a piece of paper in front of him with some handwritten lines on it. He seems to be using that as his text. And he says in these words, I have been assigned to tell you that because of your views of the U.S. government, which are contrary to those of this agency, referring to Goodwill as a nonprofit agency, because of your views of the U.S. government, which are contrary to those of this agency, you are a disruptive force and cannot work here anymore. Take your things and go. I asked him if I could have a copy of what he read from. He said no. I asked if I could have his business card. He said no. You have to go. He walked me out where there's a security guard waiting at my car to make sure I left the area. I believe this is a serious attack on all workers' rights to be able to speak out on issues from unions to war policies without fear of losing their job, without fear of harassment on the job. And so I've helped initiate a committee to defend free speech and the Bill of Rights in Miami, with committees being formed in other cities around the country. I'm on a national tour right now, speaking out against these attacks on myself and other issues like the one that you mentioned just a moment ago, the high school student who was kicked out of school for expressing her opposition to the war. This is a serious attack on people to be able to speak out, and especially workers on the job, where there was another worker in Miami who was recently fired, Muhammad Rahat. He's a 22-year-old lab tech at the University of Miami, supposedly an institution of higher learning and intellectual debate. He was a lab tech on September 11th, happened to be his birthday. And he said a sarcastic remark along the lines of, this is a hell of a birthday present from Osama bin Laden. And then in a private conversation, he said to a coworker, while he didn't like at all what happened at the World Trade Center, it didn't surprise him considering U.S. policy in the Middle East. A third person overheard him say this to someone else, reported to the supervisor, who then suspended Mr. Rahat and a few days later fired him. This made the front page of the Miami Herald. The administration was asked about this. The president of University of Miami is Donna Shalala of Clinton administration fame. She has not commented on this, but a university spokesperson, when told that Mr. Rahat had an excellent work record, said his work record is immaterial. We fired him for what he said. What's important about these firings is that they're blatant political firings. Usually when an employer wants to get rid of someone they don't like, they say you have a bad work record or poor attendance or some other excuse. In this case, he said straight up, I'm firing you for your political views. He said this to the Miami Herald. He said this to television news. He said that, to quote him, we cannot have anyone who is attempting to subvert the United States of America in this plant. His political beliefs are those of a communist who would like to destroy private ownership of American enterprises and install a communist regime in the United States. No other excuse. And recently, I've actually won a victory along these lines, in which the state of Florida has ruled as well that I was fired for my political views. I filed for unemployment when I was fired 6 weeks ago, stating that the reason for my discharge was being fired for political views. they asked the company for its response to my accusation. The company did not respond. And on Monday, I received a check for $781 for 6 weeks at $158 a week, roughly, on unemployment benefits. And they also sent a determination, their findings. And it says Mr. Talley was discharged for his political views. No evidence of misconduct on the job was indicated. Therefore, I receive the benefits.
Now, in reading the Miami Herald pieces on your firing, the president of Goodwill, the factory in Miami, very much stood up for the CEO, whatever the guy who heads the company, you being fired for your political beliefs. He had carefully researched it legally, he said.
He stated to the Miami Herald that he had talked to his attorneys, and you can tell from, if you know this guy, you can tell he doesn't like the fact that his attorneys told him that he could not fire someone for race, religion, or national origin, but he could fire someone for his political views. And he said after talking to his attorneys, he decided he would fire me for my political views. But there's an extra danger in that, because implied there is he cannot fire you because you're black, but he can fire you if you advocate black rights. He can't fire you for being a woman, but he can fire you for advocating women's rights. He can't fire you for being an immigrant, but he can fire you for advocating bilingual education. So I think it very much gets to the heart of the first, if you don't have the First Amendment, a right to speak and advocate your ideas, then all of the other rights on the job can soon go out the window, whether it's the fight against discrimination on the job in all forms.
The ACLU, though, Michael Attali, said that they would not represent you in your case, what you called a free speech case.
That's true. After I held a press conference at the factory and the media asked the ACLU of Miami their opinion on this, they said they would not. They make a distinction that a private employer, they say, if it's not union, and this place was not union, and if you're not in a what's called a protected category, such as race, religion, national origin, then a private employer can fire you for any reason or no reason at all. I disagree with that. Maybe 90% of the population works for private employers and without a union, unfortunately. I don't believe that the First Amendment goes out the window once you walk into that factory or office or other workplace. And in fact, while the ACLU has not changed its legal position on this, the executive director of the Florida ACLU, Howard Simon, spoke at a program in Miami just this past Saturday, a panel of speakers in which I participated, stating that my firing, the firing of Mohammed Rahat, are serious attacks on democratic rights, come in the context of the military tribunals and other attacks from the Bush administration, and these attacks need to be spoken out against.
Can you talk about the press conference that you held outside of the factory and what happened to the workers inside when you did?
Yes. I knew as soon as they fired me, I was going to fight this firing. And several days later, I held a press conference outside the plant. Most people get out at 4:30. And so I scheduled the press conference for 4 p.m., hoping to be able to talk to coworkers, get them information about why they fired me. So the company found out about this because the media asked them what their response was to my charges of a political firing. So at 2:30 in the afternoon, I found this out from friends who work in the plant. At 2:30 in the afternoon, they went around to everybody and told them, Mike is going to be outside with the media having a press conference. At 3 o'clock, I want everybody in the factory to leave. We're closing the plant an hour and a half early because we don't want you staying around, talking to Mike, talking to the media, finding out what's happening. And in fact, don't clock out at 3 o'clock, but write down on your time card 4:30 so you get a full day's pay. The media, I had this on tape, actually, the media that covered my press conference went to the security guard at the plant at 3 o'clock, they happened to get there earlier or a little bit after 3, and said, you know, the plant has been closed down, what's going on? They wouldn't comment, so they asked, can we go in and talk to the administration? They said, no, we're not allowing the media in here at all. No one can talk to you. You'll have to come back another time. I talked to a coworker about this, why she thought why they closed it early. And she said, this was very good, very deep what she said. She said they closed the plant early because they didn't want the media talking to us, the workers in the factory, because then the conditions in the plant might get publicity, might get out. that Goodwill Industries, which presents itself as a benefactor and aid to the disabled, pays people, the vast majority of people make less than $14,000 a year, receive no medical benefits, and many people are paid less than the minimum wage because there are exceptions to the minimum wage laws that they're allowed to pay disabled people less than minimum wage. So they pay people by the piece, and they pay, including disabled workers, piece rate. And so I have coworkers who have one good arm and are working putting two pieces of material together, and they take home, we get paid every 2 weeks. And it's not uncommon for disabled workers to get a two-week paycheck, 80 hours, of $75, $100, $125. They don't want these facts getting out.
And these are people who are making the American flag?
Including people who make, I'm sure it includes people making the American flag, yes.
And you were stitching Navy wear?
I was working on the pieces of the front of Navy jackets.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Michael Attali, who worked at a Goodwill factory in Miami, fired explicitly for expressing his point of view against the war in Afghanistan. He was running for Miami mayor on the Socialist Workers Party ticket. What did the other candidates say about you?
Well, two other candidates, there were 10 candidates in all in the race, two other candidates signed statements opposing the firing. That was very good. Jose Garcia Pedrosa and Danny Couch each spoke against the firing. But one, the libertarian candidate, Mr. Atunes, he said that he didn't give an opinion about what he thought about the firing, but he thought it was an employer's right to fire someone for any reason, and he didn't think that employers should be prevented from firing someone for race, religion, or national origin either. It's up to the employer to have free choice in this matter. But he also said that he didn't think the employer was so much concerned with my opinion on Afghanistan, but the fact that I support a $10 an hour minimum wage, that would be a direct cut in his profits. And this candidate, totally serious without joking, said, and that scares me too, because he's a businessman. He doesn't want to have to pay people higher wages.
Michael Attali, if people want to get in touch with you, where can they call or go on the web?
The local number in the New York area is 718-434-4776. And the Committee to Defend Free Speech and the Bill of Rights is having a meeting on Thursday, December 20th at 6 p.m. It's going to be held at the Union Hall for the Communication Workers of America, Local 1180. That's at 6 Harrison Street, the third floor. And that's 6 Harrison Street, which is between Hudson and Leonard Streets.
And that's in Manhattan. And we'll put it on our website at democracynow.org. I want to thank you very much for being with it. That does it for the program. Sorry, we are out of time. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner, Suganya Mahendra, and Matthew Power. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Al Maitland at the helm at WBIX. You can reach us at mail@democracynow.org. Special thanks to Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. We're also broadcasting on public access cable stations and on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Let the joyous news be spread. Let the joyous news be spread. The wicked old witch at last is dead.